We began our series on Jewish medical ethics on Tuesday evening, and the recording didn't work, so I am re-recording it for the benefit of those who requested a recorded version of the class and those who could not attend. We began our whole study of Jewish medical ethics, which will be a series of five classes over the next several weeks, with a general view of medicine and practicing medicine in Jewish law. One of my favorite passages in Chassidut is from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who lived in the late 18th century, was not a fan of doctors. And he writes on the top of page 2 in Sichot Haran, Sichanun, Minyan doktorim rufuot hirba ledaber imanu me'od. He used to talk a lot about doctors and medicine. Now, remember, Rabbi Nachman did not write his own writings. It was written by Rabbi Natan, his student. So he spoke to us about it a lot, means Rabbi Natan is saying that Rabbi Nachman spoke about it a lot. And he used to speak poorly and negatively about doctors and medicine. ומזיר מאוד מאוד לכל מי שרוצה לחוס על חייו ועל חיי זרעו ובני ביתו, שיתרחק עצמו מאוד בתכלית הריחוק מלעסוק חס ושלום ברפואות ודוקטורים. And he used to warn us that whoever wants to protect his own life and the life of his children and the people in his household should stay very far away from dealing with medicine and doctors. Furthermore, וסיפר שכשהיה בקהילת קודש למברג, when he was in Lemberg, שהוא מקום קיבוץ דוקטורים גדולים, which is a place of gathering of great doctors. I suppose they had some kind of medical conference there. העיד לפניו דוקטור גדול בעצמו, שטוב להתרחק מרפואות ודוקטורים בתכלית הריחוק. One great doctor himself said, it's a good idea to stay away from doctors. A great doctor said that. ואמר שכבר חקרו כל כך בחוכמת הדוקטוריה, עד שעכשיו אינם יודעים כלל וכלל, לא כי מריבוי חקירתם. כבר ראו שאי אפשר לחקור ולברר אמיתת הדברים על מכונם. He said that they have done so much research in medicine that now they don't know anything. Because of all of the research that they've done, they figured out that they cannot figure out anything at all. They don't know anything really at its source. גם יש מחלוקות גדולות ביניהם בענייני הרפואות. And they also have many debates about them. נמצא שאפשר לסמוך על הדוקטורים מאחר שהם בעצמם מבולבלים מאוד מאוד בחוכמה זו, ואי אפשר להם לעמוד על האמת לאמיתו. And we found now, in conclusion, that we cannot trust doctors at all, because they themselves are mixed up in this wisdom, in this field of knowledge, and they don't know the truth itself. Now, what all the doctors agreed upon in the, with many, many doctors who attended the class, and all of them immediately agreed that when dealing with 18th century medicine, Rabbi Nachman was no doubt right. You were better off staying away from doctors in the 18th century than you were going to them. Nowadays, you know, I don't know if Rabbi Nachman would agree. I don't know if it was I don't know if Rabbi Nachman was responding to the medicine of his time or if he was saying a theological statement about doctors. It sounds like he's talking about a practical consideration. Elsewhere in Sicha Nun, I didn't include it, he does speak more about theology and what it means to trust doctors as opposed to trusting God, but that seems to go directly against the Gemara itself. The Gemara itself is very pro-healing from doctors, assuming they know what they're doing. The Pasuk in Parashat Mishpatim says, that when you are dealing with an injury, you have to pay all the damages involved with the injury, and one of those damages is the healing from the injury. So there is a double language, Verapo Yerape. So the Midrash Halacha writes, the bottom of page 2, in the middle of the first line of the Gemara, the Vei Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Verapo Yerape, Mikan Shenitan Reshut LaRofe Lerapot. Rabbi Yishmael derives from the verse Verapo Yerape that here we learn that the doctor has the right to heal. He's allowed, he has the permission, the halachic permission to heal. Rashi fills us in. He tells us, "Ve'lo amrin an rachman amachi v'yumasi." We don't say, but you might have thought, that if somebody is ill or injured, we say, well, God led him to this injury. God has given him this illness. We should not interfere. We should not interfere and try to heal him because clearly God wants this person to be ill. And you could imagine a religious perspective that says, it's a Christian Scientist perspective, that says the illness that was given from God, and we do not do anything to try to heal this person. The verse therefore tells us that that's not true. Again, it's a reasonable religious perspective, but it is not the Jewish perspective. The Gemara says we have a verse specifically to tell us that that's not the perspective. And the Tosfot here add another layer to this. V'im tomar v'hamirapeh l'chudesh mei, v'im tomar v'hamirapeh l'chudesh mei nanlei, v'yesh lomar da'va amina ne'milei makah bidei adam, aval choli haba bidei shamayim k'shemirapeh. You might have thought that that is one rapo would have been enough to tell us that a doctor is allowed to heal. There are two. It's rapo yirape. It's doubled. And they tell us that it's doubled because otherwise I might have thought that a human-caused injury is one that a doctor may heal, but a God-given illness, meaning an illness that comes naturally, we're not allowed to heal because then it looks like we are contradicting the will of God. Kamash malan deshari means that even though it's a natural illness, we are allowed to heal it. And so therefore, everybody agrees that doctors are allowed to heal whether it's a human-caused illness or an injury or a natural or God-caused injury or illness. we then turn the discussion to our topic for this class, which is about the general concept of personal autonomy in medical decision-making, which is a less practical topic, less directly practical topic than some of the other topics we will discuss, but one that will guide us throughout. After all, almost all of our discussions will center around decisions that we make. To what extent does halakha recognize or believe that we have the right to make our own decisions? Now, this is not a topic that is unique to halakha. In the general medical community, there is a principle and a value of personal autonomy in medical decision making. Doctors have assigned consent forms, telling us, you know, having a sign that we consent to their performance of a surgery or their treatment of our illness. And this represents a somewhat new perspective in medicine. It used to be, and now we're on page 3 where I have, the source of all knowledge is Wikipedia. So I included some brief materials from there. But medical paternalism was the general value or principle that existed for hundreds of years. And that's really what the Hippocratic Oath is based on, that doctors should do whatever it takes to heal their patient and to promote the health of their patient. And they shouldn't even tell patients everything. The Hippocratic Oath advises that physicians conceal most information from patients to give the patients the best care. The rationale is a beneficence model for care. The doctor knows better than the patient and therefore should direct the patient's care because the patient is not likely to have better ideas than the doctor. Nowadays, that is not seen as the right thing. That is seen as, even the word paternalistic sounds negative to our ears. Personal autonomy is the value that that most in the medical community share today. And that is that it is up to a patient, up to a human being, to decide how they'd like to be treated, whether they'd like to be treated. It is the doctor's role to assess the situation using his or her expertise and to make suggestions, to teach, to inform the patient so that the patient can then make an informed decision as to which treatment they like to take or if to take a treatment at all. And so our question is whether Judaism values such a personal autonomy or whether Judaism values medical paternalism. That is, that the doctors who are considered the experts. After all, we have a concept of mumche, of experts in Jewish law. So maybe doctors are considered mumchim and we should trust them and not take into consideration personal decisions at all. One doctor who was in the room who had some familiarity with the topic immediately raised his hand and suggested that he has heard that in Judaism, we believe that we do not own our own bodies, that our bodies are on loan from God. So that's really, he anticipated the next phase of our discussion, and that is that idea. Maimonides hints to it in the Laws of Murder. He writes, when it comes to monetary theft and things like that, we pay back we pay someone for damage to their property or injury or anything like that, but we are not allowed to take a ransom for murder. Murder incurs the death penalty, even if the family. So let's read it. And the court is warned not to take, we're on page 4. The court is warned not to take a ransom from the murderer, even if they will give all the money in the world. And even if the redeemer of blood wishes to exempt them. Meaning, even if the family of the victim says, we don't want this guy to get the death penalty, we'd rather get money, we don't take it. For the life of this person who was killed is not the possession of the redeemer of blood, but rather the possession of God. As it says, Lo tikhun kofer lenefesh rotzeach. Do not take a ransom for the life of the murderer. So Maimonides here hints to that idea. Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin made a big deal of this one principle. And he's really probably the most oft-quoted source for this principle nowadays, because he wrote such a big essay about it. The essay, look at this essay on page 4. Mishpat Shailak Lefi Ha'alacha. Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin was bothered by the plot in The Merchant of Venice. In The Merchant of Venice, Shylock lends Antonio some money, and if Antonio can't pay it back, he has to give Shylock a pound of his own flesh. I hate to spoil this for you if you have not... If you haven't read it by now, it's about time. But at the end of The Merchant of Venice, Antonio cannot pay back the money, and Shylock demands his pound of flesh, and there's a dramatic court scene that ensues. Now, Rav Zevin was bothered by this because he said, if Shylock, first of all, he says, this play has led to so many anti-Semitic tropes and a negative view of the Jewish people all around the world. He writes, Shylock could never have made this demand because Shylock was a Jew. And in Judaism, we don't own our own bodies. It was not Shylock's right to demand that pound of flesh. And so, here is where he derives that from. First, it comes from another passage in the Rambam in the Laws of Injury, Ilchot Chovel Umazik. The Rambam writes, "Asur le'adam lachbol ben be'atzmo ben lechaverot." It's forbidden to injure yourself or somebody else. Not only one who inflicts a wound, but anyone who strikes a worthy Jew, whether adult or a minor, whether a man or a woman, breaks this law. As it is written, he must not lash him excessively. That is, if somebody gets lashes as a punishment, then the court is only allowed to administer the amount of lashes that they are required to administer, and not more. If the Torah is warned against excess in lashing an offender, how much more should this apply to striking an innocent man? So, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin, who was a Lubavitcher Chassid and a member of the Beit Din, the chief rabbinate's Beit Din in Yerushalayim, in the first half of the 20th century up until the late 70s, He points us to a passage in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, wrote his own halachic sefer. He writes like this, page 5. Koach ha-chaim shel guf ha-adam einena shelo. Life does not belong to us. Shel ha-adam. Zoya nekuda, that's the point. Our bodies do not belong to us. Lo bilvad she-adam asur la-abed et chayav kulam u-miktzatam. Not only that we're not allowed to commit suicide or destroy our lives, either partially or fully, but life does not belong to us at all. If he gives or sells a piece of his flesh to someone, either a part of his flesh to someone, it's like you're selling something that doesn't belong to you, which according to Jewish law, and I imagine any law, such a sale does not take effect. You can't sell something that doesn't belong to you. Hashem natan veHashem lakach einena melitza shel tarchumin greida ela shezoi hagdarat hametziut. The Lord hath given and the Lord hath taken away, which you recite as part of Tziduk HaDin during a burial. It's not just a beautiful poetic part of our liturgy. The Lord hath given and the Lord hath taken away. But it is an expression of reality. Natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu HaChaim LaAdam SheYishtamesh Bahem. God gave us life to use them, to use it. Aval lo shiyu knuim lo la'asot bahem ke'adam ha'oseh betoch shelo. But not that they are owed by us to do with it whatever we want to do with it, like we do with our possessions. Lakachet et ha'chaim b'chazdara efshar rak lemi shenetanam. Taking life back is possible, is allowed only to the one who gave them to us, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, to God, ולא לאדם עצמו, not to human beings. איננו בעל הבית במובן זה על עצמו. We are not owners, we're not balabatim on ourselves. מניין היסוד להנחה הזו מבחינה הלכתית? Where did this come from in principle? Where did this halachic principle come from? הערני לראשונה על יסוד זה לשונו של אדמור הזקן, בעל התניא, בשולחן ערוך שלו. My attention was first drawn to this principle by the Alter Rebbe in his Shulchan Aruch HaRav. Shadam asur lachbol be'atzmo mevuar b'mishnah uv'gemara uv'poskim. The fact that you're not allowed to injure yourself, that's found in the Mishnah and in the Talmud and in the commentaries. We already read the Rambam on that. Ela shebemakom shebechol otam ha-mekorot katuv she'ino rasha yo she'asur. But in all of those sources where it says that you're not allowed to injure yourself, or that it's prohibited to injure yourself. The Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, wrote it in the following manner. You're not allowed to hit your friend, your peer, even if he gives you permission. Because it's not your right. You don't have permission. You don't have the Rishut, the authority on your body to have it hit. By the way, as kind of an explanation, the Alter Rebbe included a beautiful point. We do not have the right to injure ourselves. And he goes on and on. He points out that this principle is not found anywhere in the classical sources. But he says that there are a number of hints, a number of pieces of evidence for it. probably his most central piece of evidence is from Tractate Sanhedrin, which is found on the bottom of page 5. In the olden days, the days of the Talmud, bloodletting was the central medical activity for healing. They felt that letting out blood would be a way to heal certain illnesses. And the doctors in the room confirmed that that was indeed a common view of medicine. Now, one is not supposed to injure somebody. So how can you let blood out if you have to necessarily, you know, prick them or puncture them? That's number one. Number two, it's even more prohibited to injure one's parents. Injuring someone incurs a number of damage, a number of fines, but injuring a parent incurs the death penalty. So, is a son allowed to let blood for his father? Ibailau ben Moshe kiz dam le'aviv. Rav Matna amar, Rav Matna says, "Ve'aftal le'reacha kamocha." You should love your neighbor as you love yourself. Meaning, you'd want yourself to be healed, so you should let other people, you must heal others as well. But Rav Dimi bar Chinana says, amar, "Makeh adam u'makeh be'ema." There is a parallel between striking people and striking an animal. Ma make behema lerefua patur, af make adam lerefua patur. Striking an animal for the purposes of healing it is exempt from paying the restitution. So too, one who strikes a person for medical purposes is exempt from liability. What this shows you, says Rav Zevin, is that we do not have, he says that this passage indicates that we do not have ownership over our bodies. After all, if we were to own our bodies just like we own other objects, we would be allowed to injure it for any purpose. But we're only allowed to injure it for medical purposes, not for other purposes. What this shows us is that there is a limitation to what control, what authority we have over our own bodies. This principle was used by Poskim, by rabbinic decisors for many, many years, to limit what people can do. There are many responses I could have included, but I found one response in here that actually quotes a number of great quotes from earlier rabbis in which they ruled according to this principle. It's on page 6 on the top right-hand side from Rabbi Gedalia Aaron Rabinovich. He's a contemporary rabbi. He lives in Israel. In the 60s, he lived in Chicago. And he quotes, he was asked about a young girl who is part of a large, very religious Orthodox family. But she herself has become very promiscuous, and she goes out to parties every night. And then she comes home and tells all of her siblings about all the parties she went to. And not only that, she is both physically and mentally ill and requires treatment, but she's not interested in going to a facility that will treat her in the proper manner. So her parents asked Rabbi Rabinowitz, if they are allowed to coerce her to go to such an institution so that she can live outside of the house and get the treatment she needs. So he quotes, first he quotes the response of the Radbaz, who lived in the 16th century in Spain and then in Israel. The Radbaz wrote, "Katav gabe mi sheino rotze sheyachalel Shabbat b'shvil refuato shekofino to sheyitrape." The Radbaz was asked if some people have very religious sensibilities, and even though they know in theory that pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat, that saving a life overrides Sabbath prohibitions, they don't want somebody breaking Shabbos in order to save them because of their religious sensibilities. So the Radbaz writes that if somebody refuses medical treatment because they don't want someone breaking Shabbat, we coerce them to accept the medical treatment. We don't listen to them and say no, we don't listen to them, but rather we listen to the doctor who says that you have to break Shabbat in order to save them. The Mishnah Berurah paskins in that way. And then he quotes Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who lived in the 18th century in Germany. And he writes, he writes, בכל עניין ואופן שנתנה תורה רשות לרופא לרפאותו. Rabbi Yaakov Emden writes that if a doctor is dealing with a known medicine, בתרופה בדוקה וגמורה, a medicine that he knows very, very well, and it's a And the doctor is familiar with this illness very, very well. And he says, this medicine will cure this illness. We must coerce the patient any way we can. Someone is not allowed to say, we don't accept the treatment. Then he quotes Rabbi David Tzvi Hoffman in response to Melamed Lehoil. שכתב די אחד הרופאים אומרים שיש לעשות ניתוח או להשתמש באיזה תרופה והורי הילד אינם רוצים לשמוע לדעת הרופאים אין משגיחים בדעת ההורים ועושים כדבעי. He says that if parents refuse treatment to their children, whether it's surgery or medicine, but the doctors say that this is the kind of surgery or medicine that's necessary, we don't listen to the parents and we do whatever the doctor says we have to do. and finally, the Tzitz Eliezer in a response, I'm over here on the bottom left, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who lived in the 20th century in Israel. He was the posek for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Yerushalayim, which is a halachic hospital. Because he was the posek for a halachic hospital, he wrote many medical responses, and we're going to see his writings come up again and again. Probably in every class in this series. But here he writes about someone who doesn't want to go to the doctor, whether it's Shabbos or not Shabbos, but he really should go to the doctor. We force him to go to the doctor. So, based on all these sources, we see that they quote this principle that we don't own our own bodies, and therefore we don't have rights to make medical decisions. It would seem that we have no personal autonomy in medicine, but rather we must always listen to the doctors. One of my teachers, Dr. David Schatz, took issue with this. First of all, he said that the ownership principle, this is in an essay, I included parts of it on page 6 and 7. First of all, he writes, the ownership principle does not necessarily lead to that idea. The ownership thesis is a way of restating the fact that we must obey Jewish law. All that it says, that the fact that we don't own our bodies, but God owns our bodies, is that there is Jewish law, and we must follow Jewish law when it comes to our bodies, just like we must follow Jewish law when it comes to anything at all. It cannot determine the content of what halacha rules in a particular case. The halacha has to be determined by jurisprudential reasoning, not an invocation of theology. Ownership provides only an argument for obeying God once he has spoken. So first of all, he says that this idea does not actually determine the halacha. It only determines the fact that we have to follow halacha once we know what that is. But perhaps there are cases where halacha does allow for personal autonomy, and perhaps there are cases where halacha might have something to say in regards to a medical decision, not just that you have to listen to the doctors. That's point one. He then continues, let us now consider the argument that Judaism denies autonomy because in sharp contrast to bioethics, it licenses kfiya, coercion, to medical treatment. If medical treatment can be coerced, how can there be room for autonomy? The basic reply to this question is that medical treatment can be coerced only in cases when there is a suitably weighty risk-benefit ratio. If some risk-free procedure, a medication, for example, will cure a life-threatening condition, then a patient who refuses the treatment is coerced into accepting it. But where the risk-benefit ratio is more complex, Jewish law does not coerce medical treatment, and the patient may decide how to proceed. In earlier times, maybe in the days of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, of the Radbaz, of David Tzvi Hoffman, the risk-benefit ratio, the medical modalities were simple. The alternatives clear and uncomplicated. Take treatment X or die. In such a case, it's true. You have to take treatment X. In modern times, modalities have proliferated, and the alternatives are anything but simple. Already in the Talmud, though, we find Rebbe refusing two medications for eye disease, saying, I cannot endure it, accepting only a third treatment. Whereas Rebbe, it is true, chose some treatment. Sometimes no treatment might be as reasonable as treatment. He continues to write that there is a permissible zone. There are clear black and white cases, and there are gray areas. In some cases, there is great risk if medical treatment is not preferred. While the risks involved are negligible, and the likely benefits to life expectancy are enormous, here Jewish law will coerce the patient to undergo the procedure and will not grant the patient autonomy. In other cases, the procedure is very risky, while foregoing the procedure does not involve significant risk or benefit. Here a person is prohibited from undertaking the procedure. Finally, there is a gray area, a permissible zone, where uncertainty infects the decision-making. There is such and such a percentage of risk if the procedure is not done, such and such a likelihood of benefit if the procedure is done, such and such percentage of risk if the procedure is done. Assuming each of the percentages involved is not negligible, Jewish law leaves the decision in the patient's hands. That is, if it's not clear that something is life-saving or beneficial, but rather there are weighty differences between possible alternatives, and each alternative has its pluses and minuses, then indeed the individual can make his own decision. And the doctors who were in the room during this class concurred that there, as time goes on, there are more and more such cases. Especially when it comes not to the decision of whether or not to take a treatment, but when it comes to the decision of which treatment to take. Each individual has to make their own decision as to how much suffering they wish to endure, what's going to happen with each procedure. Indeed, that's exactly what my teacher, Rabbi Sherlo, wrote in his essay on the matter. Rabbi Sherlo writes on the side of the page, "Hapsika b'shela zdo chayev l'itiches lebetim rabim shel ha'metziut." This question, dealing with this question, involves looking at many different perspectives. Kegon, at kama himanut mitipul mashma mavet miyadi. To what extent does refraining from getting treatment mean immediate death? At kama gedolim sikui hatipul la'atzil et ha'adam. Sikuyei hatipul la'atzil et ha'adam. To what extent is how great are the chances that this treatment will save the person? Eizo pgiya be'echut ha'chaim mitchayevet ketotzaa me'atipul, ve'eizo pgiya be'echut ha'chaim kayemet lo tipul. What effects on quality of life will this treatment have? And what effects on quality of life will refraining from this treatment have on the person? These are all decisions that somebody has to make. At kama tipul karuch b'isurim, how much suffering will come as a result of this treatment? Etc., etc. So we see that in contemporary society, the question of personal autonomy is a little bit more complex than it was in earlier times. So the other point, however, that Dr. Schatz makes is that whereas personal autonomy and decision in medical decision making in secular bioethics is a value, in Judaism it is not a value, but rather only a fact of the system. What I mean to say, and what he means, is that in secular bioethics, it is considered a goal that people should be informed and make decisions for themselves about their bodies. Whereas in Jewish ethics, personal autonomy or decision-making is just a fact that needs to happen. Decisions have to be made because the alternatives and which alternative is better than the other is not always clear. And no doctor and no rabbi can make that decision for somebody. How much suffering are they willing to endure and so forth. So it is a fact that people have to make decisions in medicine, but it's not a value per se. The value is preserving life rather than one's own personal decisions. From here, I'd like to turn our discussion to a more specific area. The reason why I grouped these two topics together is that there's one area in modern medicine that is entirely about personal autonomy, in which there is no medical need, but there is possible psychological need. There are needs that are perceived by a person, and that is an elective cosmetic surgery. If somebody doesn't like the way they look, are they allowed to undergo elective cosmetic surgery? Or do we say that this procedure is not medically necessary and therefore it's prohibited? Our default, after all, is that self-injury is prohibited unless it's needed for a medical need. That's exactly what the passage in Sanhedrin said with regards to bloodletting. We only allow injury if it's for a medical need. So is this perceived feeling that one wants to look more beautiful or more handsome, is that a medical need or not? So on page 8, the Tzitz Eliezer was very opposed to elective cosmetic surgery. You saw Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg earlier. This is from the very same responsum. First of all, he said that from a halachic perspective, it is not warranted injury. Surgery necessarily involves injury. That's what surgery means. And that's only allowed to heal someone from a medical condition, in medical necessity. This does not qualify. Not only is it halachically wrong, says the Tzitz Eliezer, but it is theologically wrong. It is philosophically wrong. Quotes a story from Masechet Ta'anit. An incident occurred in which Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, came from Migdal Gedor, from his rabbi's house. He was riding on a donkey and strolling on the bank of the river. And he was very happy, and his head was swollen with pride because he had studied much Torah. He happened upon an exceedingly ugly person who said to him, "Greetings to you, my rabbi." But Rabbi Elazar did not return his greeting. Instead, he said to him, "Reka, worthless person, how ugly are you? Are all the people of your city as ugly as you?" The man said to him, "I don't know, but you should go and say to the craftsman who made me, namely, God, how ugly is the vessel you made?" Rabbi Elazar realized that he'd committed a grave sin, and he asked forgiveness. Tzitz Eliezer says, God has given us the way we look. He has given us our physical bodies, and we should be happy with the image that God has chosen for us. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein disagreed with the Tzitz Eliezer. What's interesting is that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein does not bring in the theological or philosophical issue at all. He writes purely on a halachic basis. And he has a number of pieces of evidence that this injury that the cosmetic surgery entails is a permitted one. And here's his evidence. First, his evidence comes from the language of Maimonides. We already saw this law. I printed it again at the top of page 10. Listen to the words in Hebrew. Asur la'adam lachbol ben be'atzmo ben be'chaviro. It's prohibited to injure oneself or another. Ve'lo ha'chovel bilvad, ela kol ha'makeh adam kasher mi'Yisrael. Not only one who inflicts a wound, but anyone who strikes a Jew. Ben katan ben gadol, whether a minor or an adult. Ben ish ben isha, whether a man or a woman. Derech nitzayon, in a belligerent manner. Harei ze over belo ta'aseh, has broken a negative commandment, a lo ta'aseh, a prohibitive law. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says, note the word derech nitzayon, in a belligerent manner. He points out that other manuscripts of the Rambam have it as derech bizayon, in a degrading manner. We see from this that the Rambam thinks that only striking or injury that is belligerent in nature, or possibly degrading in nature, is prohibited. But striking or injury, which is not belligerent and not degrading, is not prohibited. Now, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is aware that these two words, derech nitzayon or derech bizayon, are not found in the Talmud. Where did he get it from? Where did the Rambam get this notion from? Rabbi Feinstein suggests that he got it from his reading of the Talmud. The Talmud quotes a number of opinions regarding injuring oneself. First, it quotes, and now we're back on page 9. First, it quotes Rabbi Akiva, who writes that although it's not permitted to injure oneself, one is exempt from the penalties. Then it quotes a dispute between Tanaim as to whether or not it's permitted to injure oneself. So far we've seen two passages. Then it quotes up the possibility of Rabbi Chisda. There, Rabbi Chisda found himself in an interesting situation. He had to walk through some thorns. If he were to walk through some thorns with his pants where they are, his pants would get torn up. If he lifted his pants, his skin would get scratched. He would get injuries into his skin. One of them is the prohibition of chavala be'atzmo. One of them is don't injure yourself. The other one transgresses the prohibition of bal tashchit, of wasting material. Rav Chisda lifted up his pants and preferred that his skin get scratched rather than that his pants get scratched. Why? Because the skin is going to heal and my pants are not going to heal. That is, one is worse than the other. So we see that Rav Chisda had a much lower view of whether or not you're allowed to injure yourself, meaning his requirement for why one might be permitted to injure oneself is much lower, much more lenient than just medicine. Unlike what we saw Rabbi Zevin write based on the passage about bloodletting, Rabbi Chisda clearly thinks that injuring oneself in order to protect one's pants is permitted. So Rabbi Feinstein writes that the Rambam read all of these passages in the Talmud and said, well, what we see from all these passages, Rav Chisda, Rabbi Akiva, etc., is that yes, injuring oneself is prohibited, but if you're injuring yourself for a positive purpose, not necessarily a medical purpose, but a positive purpose, that injury is permitted. Take a look at Rav Moshe Feinstein on the left on page 10. On the right, he wrote the Maimonides, inference from Derech Nitzayon. But then he writes, Yesh le'avir ha'ayah l'shitat ha'rambam. Me'ad amar be'bavakama sham, Rav Chisda kadhava maski bini hizmi, ve'gamad li la'o le'mane. Amar, ze ma'ale aruka, ve'ze ino ma'ale aruka. He quotes a story about Rav Chisda. Im kol ha'chovel chayav, איך היה מותר לו ללך בין ההזמי? והנה בלא בגדים, שכבול בעצמו. If injuring oneself, in any case, is prohibited, how is he allowed to walk through the thorns without clothes on? He was injuring himself. היה עבור האיסור חובל בעצמו. ואף שאינו מתכוון, הווה פסיק רשע, תדוחק לומר, דיה באופן שלא היה פסיק רשע. And even if he would say it's davar she'no mitkaven, that he had no intention of injuring himself, meaning he just walked through, it is a psik resha, meaning it was certainly going to happen. Walking through the thorns, certainly going to injure himself. ולכן צריך לומר דייסור חובל הוא רק דרך ניסיון. כיוון שהיה הליכתו לצורך, הרי אין זה דרך ניסיון. ולכייסור. Injuring oneself is only prohibited if it's in a belligerent manner, if it's דרך ניסיון. And therefore, and he had to walk through the thorns. He had to get to the other side. So walking through the thorns was not done in a belligerent manner. Obviously, if he wanted to walk through the thorns in order to injure himself, that's belligerent. But if he's just walking to get to the other side, it's not.
ונצטרך לומר, זה לצורך שאסור הוא דברים שעושה אותם לכוונת צער.
It's prohibited to do things if you do them specifically in order to suffer. We're not allowed to cause suffering to us. That's from the next part of the Talmud. You could read the whole thing in English here on page 9 or in the Hebrew. But Rabbi Elazar HaKapar has strong words to say for someone who causes himself to suffer. One is not allowed to cause oneself to suffer. So Moshe Feinstein says, so long as you're not causing yourself to suffer, but you're doing, you are ipso facto injuring yourself in order to accomplish something positive, then it's allowed. And in this case, he permits it because somebody wants, his questioner wished to have cosmetic surgery because she was uncomfortable with some way that she looked. And she thought she'd have a better chance at Shiduchim if she had this cosmetic surgery. I'm not getting into the, Rav Moshe Feinstein leaves aside any philosophical discussion as to whether or not that is a good religious perspective or not. And I'm not going to get into that either in this class. In any event, to sum up what we've seen, we saw first the general permission granted by the Talmud for doctors to heal. We are not Christian scientists. We do not say that since God has made this person ill, therefore he must accept God's decree, but rather we have doctors and we allow doctors to heal. We then looked at whether or not we own our own bodies. We saw that Rabbi Zevin, quoting a number of sources, thought that we do not own our own bodies, and that general principle, which Rav Zevin illustrates, that general principle has been used by rabbis for hundreds of years to coerce patients to accept medical treatment on Shabbat, whether it's on Shabbat and they don't want to accept transgression of Shabbat, whether it's for their children and they don't want to accept medicine for their children, but the doctors say they should. Saw a number of those cases. We then saw that Dr. Schatz questioned whether or not these cases and this extreme view of, I guess we'll call it medical paternalism, is true today as well. Dr. Schatz argued that it was true back then, but not true today, because back then everything was more black and white. That is, you have to take this medicine or you'll die. There were fewer gray areas. He writes that it's true that nowadays, when the question is black and white, there is no patient autonomy. You cannot choose to die over choosing to live, usually. We will get into that, to end-of-life issues, in a later class. I did not want to discuss that in this class. But usually, if it's black and white, you have to choose white. But there are many, many gray areas in which patients will have autonomy. However, it is merely a fact of the system and not a value that we have. We do not believe that people should, we do not see it as a goal that people should make their own decisions, but rather a fact that people have to make their own decisions because we can't make decisions. There are many decisions that we, the doctors and rabbis, cannot make for them. People have to decide how much they wish to suffer in order to endure a certain treatment or not endure a certain treatment and so forth. And Rav Sherlo, who does not write as a philosopher, as Dr. Schatz does, but he writes as a rabbi, as a posek, effectively agreed with that perspective. We then turned towards elective cosmetic surgery, which is entirely about patient autonomy. And we noted that the Tzitz Eliezer felt that it was not sufficient halachically, that halachically one is not allowed to injure oneself for such a cosmetic surgery, and furthermore that it is philosophically wrong. And then we saw Rav Moshe Feinstein, who did not quote any philosophical qualms, did not have any philosophical qualms with cosmetic surgery, at least not in writing. Perhaps he did in person, I don't know. Felt that because the injury was not done in a belligerent manner, but rather it's, and this seems to apply to any surgery. There's no surgery is done in a belligerent manner. It's specifically done in order to improve something, in order to do a positive thing. So Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote that in this case, this the cosmetic surgery would be permitted. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to our next class.